Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf. Once again, talking about the game we all love.
Yeah, and here we are just a couple of days after the shootout. That always a wild experience, enjoyable experience. We love it on here. Congratulations to Chris Wakelin. But more importantly, right now, we've got a very special guest with us.
We really do, Phil. And it's somebody that was right at the centre of that, I think, particularly mad edition of the shootout, which we'll come to. And we really are delighted because we will reflect on that in the company, as you say, of a very special guest. We are joined by a man who is respected throughout the game as one of snooker's very best referees. Today's guest fell in love with this sport while watching it on Eurosport growing up. And while still a teenager, he started out on his journey in refereeing. His crowning moment came when he officiated the World Championship final of 2020 at the Crucible. And earlier this month, he completed his own special Triple Crown of Major Finals, refereeing the Masters showpiece at Alexandra Palace between Mark Allen and Mark Williams. We are delighted to be joined here on Talking Snooker by Marcel Eckhart. It's good to see you, Marcel. How are you?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Thanks, Phil. Thanks for that. It was a very nice introduction. Thank you very much. No, I'm really good. Very much appreciated. Loving being on here. And yeah, I'm very good. I'm in Poland. Yesterday was still in Leicester for the shootout, but as our calendar is these days, no stop, non-stop. And yeah, over to the next one. Well, I'm very good. Thank you.
Well, of course, you're now switching to pool, aren't you, after shootout? So what do you have to do anything in particular to get your mind in a different sort of mindset when you're refereeing a sort of, obviously a different sport? I know it's the same principles.
Yeah, well, obviously the rules are different, but at the end of the day, ball's going into a pocket, and we are professional enough and experienced enough, especially to just swap from one game to the other. It's not like a completely different game at all. No.
So do you, with pool and snooker, you must be so busy now, do you have a down period? Do you have the summer off a bit like players do, or is it just non-stop now?
Yeah, during the summer weeks, we've got a few days off here and there. Depends really, as the both sports kind of like trying to avoid each other to basically being on at the same time, which helps our schedule as well, of course. But the days, and especially this period of the year, can be quite exhausting, especially if you travel from one tournament to another, with it's held in a different country. Yesterday was quite exhausting as travel toward Poland wasn't quite easy. You have taking buses and trains and stuff. Fortunately enough for us, yesterday we were picked up at the airport, which was great. Usually doesn't happen, and it was just very comfortable. But at night I just fall in bed and fall asleep. But this morning back to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's brilliant. And you've just come from the shootout, which we've already mentioned. I mean, it is so much fun. Phil, actually, I'm about to say, Phil was there one night. I wasn't there, but just on television, you really get the sense of even you guys refereeing, you're embracing it. You're not like a schoolmaster. Be quiet, you lot over there. I mean, maybe you are if they get absolutely ridiculous, but generally, you're sort of part of it. Is that deliberate? Are you kind of almost told, no, embrace it, or is that something you've sort of done naturally?
Yeah, it's a funny one, really, because, as you said, the shootout can be quite mad at some stage. And I caught myself a couple of times where I was kind of like just before raising my arm to keep the crowd as a bit down. But obviously, I realized where we are, and then I didn't do it. But it's just funny because it's so natural for us to settle the crowd down. But yeah, it was an amazing 4 days, especially the last couple of days of the shootout. I thought the crowd was absolutely amazing. And obviously, because of the nature of the tournament, you just have the hot comments throughout the tournament, but a bit over the top maybe, but they more or less behave. It's just fantastic for everyone, for us as well. I mean, I think at one point I even had kind of like goosebumps because of the rowdy crowd. It was just amazing. Really enjoyed that one.
I mean, we talk about the sort of funny things that happen in the shootout, but I mean, you had Poonjang basically being Poonjang, dancing around in the crowd. I mean, we had Dominic Dale singing Phil Haig. I didn't expect that.
Expect that, actually.
Ken Doherty dancing, players just, you know, embracing it so much. I mean, I can see the referees, obviously, I was keeping a special eye on you. You knew you were coming on. You got a smile on your face. So, Is it almost like this is what we all need in this part of the season? We have so many serious events. It's serious, of course, it's a ranking event, but it's that bit of light maybe at a time when we need it.
Yeah, from a personal point of view, I think it's a tournament that no one really can't buy. It's once a year and it's something different. And I think it's perfect. We probably miss it now if it wouldn't be on anymore. I think us referees, we love it as well. We're kind of like now used to everything. It's just, yeah, we love it.
Yeah. Is it hard in that, because pretty much anything goes, but there must be a level where you still would have to step in if some shouting was too bad or something. But obviously in a normal event, any noise, you know what to do. But is it hard to gauge where the level is to do something?
Obviously, we keep an eye on if people are over the top with, let's say, if there are any racist comments or comments towards, let's say, females. We had a few of those where some boys just didn't want to behave, and we are supported by the security guys, of course, as well. They are standing next to the stands and looking out for basically people who don't behave, and to if they notice anything or we point them out to them, then they basically get rejected from the audience because we don't have any of them. This is just not acceptable anywhere.
Yeah, if anyone can hear that, that's Marcel's the rigging of the World Championship. So it's not our houses falling down. It's all very safe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, not at all. We can hear a bit of background noise, but that's absolutely fine. I mean, we should say, shouldn't we, Chris Wakelin, first ranking event at the age of 30, after a decade as professional. I mean, this is a real breakthrough, isn't it? Phil Haig. I mean, he's reached quarterfinals before, but to go all the way, had an early blue ball challenge, which is classic, in his first match, I think, against Faraka J. And he hadn't had much of a record, a few people pointing out before, so you sort of never know at this event. It's so hard to predict. But in the end, he just sort of played so well at the end, didn't he? And just like last year, I mean, it was an earlier mistake by Julian Leclerc, but I don't think he expected 119 points to come back his way. He didn't do a lot more, did he, Phil? But he could just stand there only and watch as Wakelin just sort of took it away from him.
Yeah, that break in the final was amazing, a tournament high break. I'm sure Ali Carter, who had the previous high break, was thinking, I'm pretty safe with my £5,000 here, but it was snatched away from him at the end. And yeah, brilliant from Wakelin. So calm in his first major final. I know it's only one frame, but still to do that at the end was amazing. And yeah, there's always this constant debate whether it should be a ranking event or not, but I think it just means even more for those guys like Chris who win it, And I think, you know, if we took it away from being a rank event, maybe it just wouldn't have that sort of specialness for those guys, which I love about it, because they don't get too many days in the sun, those sort of mid-ranking players. So, yeah, delighted for him. And Julian, an amazing run from him. He looked so good throughout that tournament, just slamming in these big breaks. He's got such a presence at the table, just the size of him and the power he hits the balls with. He was sort of an exciting talent when he got on tour. He hasn't really done loads, but hopefully this will be a sort of a breakthrough. And good to have Marcel on for this, you know, more continental Europe representation.
Which we always love, don't we, Marcel? It's very important for the game.
Well, definitely. One big advantage of the sport is that it's so global. Every part of the world is kind of like playing it. And yeah, obviously being from Germany or Europe doesn't mean a lot to me, but I think from the bigger game, from the bigger perspective, it's quite a nice thing. Yeah, we should come away from the central, well, UK central game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, it's not just policemen and prime ministers getting younger, is it? I mean, 2 14-year-olds. I mean, it's just absolutely... I should say, it's not just referees getting younger, Marcel, of course, sorry. You gave me a bit of a look there. That was important to add that. Vladislav Gradinari beating On Yi and Riley Powell beating Kyron Wilson. I mean, this is quite something. I mean, Marcel, can you kind of get your head round someone of 14 having that... I don't think I can. Having the composure to go on television. Appearing in it is one thing, but to win a match, this is just a brilliant, brilliant effort.
No, I thought, especially those two, Vladislav and Riley, they looked so composed. I had the pleasure of reffing Riley in his first match against Kyron, and he didn't shake at all. It was phenomenal, I thought, for a 14-year-old. He looked probably more comfortable than many of the professionals who've been there quite a few times, I thought.
Yeah.
He was great in his interviews afterwards. He had a very sort of calm presence about him chatting away on live TV. You know, a lot of 14-year-olds would struggle to get any words out there, but he looked like he was made for it.
He really did. That was actually a fascinating one to look at, because I could see in Kyron's face, he had this kind of increasingly worried. He had about a 30-point lead, I think, didn't he, in that? And it's like, it might not be quite enough here. It just sits away from him. It was just brilliant to watch. And important to say, Phil Hay, that Rhianne Evans claimed to win as well, the first female player. She beat Stuart Bingham, and handsomely. So we had the usual thing to say about the shootout, Phil, is you never get bored for a minute. There are stories coming at you, left, right and centre. And for a viewer, it's a very compelling product, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. We've said it loads of times on here how much we like it. And... yeah, I mean, you do occasionally get sort of scrappy games that aren't the most exciting. But then, like you said before, you know, another one's coming along within the next 10 minutes. And yeah, this one was packed with stories. As you said, those two young lads winning, Rhianne winning. You know, it felt like big names falling early on, but it's hard to call them shocks. But all sorts of people coming through. And yeah, lots of fun of the fair. It was great from start to finish, I thought. There's always debate. I was just listening to the Snooker Scene podcast this morning, and our friend Dave Tindall was talking about bringing more onto the scene. And I think that's what people enjoy it so much when it's on. There is that thought, but I suppose you've got to balance it. But yeah, it's always a great, I was going to say weekend, but 4 days, Wednesday to Saturday. I think it finishing on a Saturday sort of spiced up the final day a bit. That was really good. So yeah, roll on next year.
I thought that about the Saturday, actually. I didn't give it a lot of thought before, but actually, there was something about it, because it was different. It had a different vibe. Saturday has a different energy completely as a day, frankly, and as a sporting day. And there's a lot of sport on Saturday, but I felt it took its place within those other sports quite nicely. And I agree with that. I thought there was something quite pleasing about that. Marcel, you're obviously all getting on great... as referees, how long before do you know when you're doing the shootout? And are you gutted when you don't?
Well, in general, we're receiving our days like twice a year. Once, a first time is during like the start of the season. We're getting our days up until Christmas. And then for the second half of the year, we're receiving another list with our days, excluding the World Championship, which is separate. Well, for the shootout, it's kind of like similar. So around, like, let's say, December, January, the latest we receive it there. But whether others would be disappointed. After this one, I would be disappointed, actually, if I wouldn't do it next year. Yeah, but obviously, everyone kind of like want to do it. And there are, at the moment, we're using five referees at the event, as we have got different positions to cover. And so not space for everyone, but I guess not everyone actually wants to be on the shootout, in fact, because it's just not everyone's cup of tea by the nature of it, which is understandable, but I personally don't mind it. I love it, and I'm happy to be on.
They must be big days when you find out your tournaments for the next few months. It must be an exciting open of an email or whatever it is.
Actually, yeah, we always wait for it. Sometimes we're waiting quite long as certain things are not covered yet. And you've got to bear in mind that the referees are basically the last part of organizing an event. First, you've got to know, is the tournament happening? What kind of format is it going to be? Because this dictates how many tables, how many referees, how many sessions, all this kind of things playing a role. And then the guys in the office, they decide who's going where.
So I don't know if you would have been involved, but you know, with this change from Turkey to the new tournament in Leicester, obviously whoever was going to that, that's a serious change of plans.
Yeah, I was down to do Turkey. I was down to do referee 6 days, but that's obviously unfortunately not happening this year. Whether I'm going to be in Leicester now, that hasn't been decided yet. Whether that might change, I don't know. We haven't been told yet.
No disrespect to Leicester at all, but... Yeah,
no, just not Turkey. Yeah. Quite not Turkey, is it?
But it's not quite really
nice, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, you're both being mean about Leicester at almost exactly the same time. There, yeah. that's okay. You go. I know you weren't really. I know you weren't really. You're talking it only in comparative terms, of course. Marcel, I want to ask you loads more about you specifically, you and your life and times in this game in a moment. But just one more thing on the shootout for now. I love it when fans love it. Frankly, they just adore it. And I can already see people, I see it on forums, social media. I can't wait to go next year. You know, they might be going to a big one like the Masters UK World Championship, Tour Championship. But, you know, this is one they'll target, many people. And in the foyer, and I've not been there, but it just seems like there's quite a lot of room there, the bar area. People are forever getting photos with the stars and television personalities, referees, of course, everyone that's part of this kind of snooker community. Do you love that part of it as well? It feels like a proper community feel at the shootout.
Definitely. I wouldn't separate from any other tournament. I think, personally, the snooker scene is quite open in that regard. Mm. I can't think of many other professional sports where it's possible to get this close to the stars of the game, basically. At the shootout, you've got the chance after every match, just position yourself in an ideal position, and players going to stop for you for photos, autographs, whatever you like. It works really well because it's a bit more relaxed as well. And you know, we as referees, we are happy to do the same as players, of course, because we understand that people are coming to watch. And at the end of the day, it's an entertainment business. And that's what the crowd wants to have. They want to enjoy themselves, and we are happy to give them that, 100%.
And I think I saw that our friend Rob Francis on Twitter won your shirt. Is that right?
Well, it must be if you said that. I wasn't there at the time. Yeah, we were provided with four shirts, and I was just wearing a couple during those 4 days, so I gave two away. And then it was Robin in the end. It was quite fantastic because we had a bit of we were tweeting the other week where he told me that apparently the two maximums he watched live were both refereed by me. And I thought that was just quite a coincidence. But, so he's taking this as a souvenir, I assume.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
No, but honest to God, the shootout as it works at the moment is just fantastic. I mean, I'm the kind of guy, you won't see me laugh around the table. It's just not my nature, but there it's just, I just can't help it because of some of the comments the crowd is coming out with. It's just, they just make you laugh. Yeah, at one point, I just need to tell myself, don't look into that area now because I'm going to lose it because I just won't be able to stop laughing. It's just so good.
I just thought of something else. How stressful was it in that frame where match where the beeps went? Because, oh, we lost the beeps. And the crowd is doing show, we sing the beeps for you. Yeah. And you're sort of, you're loving it, but it's quite so actually, Alan McManus has praised you in the commentary of that, said, oh, you dealt with that very well. You were very across that situation. But that must have been a sort of very quick piece of extra stress for you.
Yeah, the incident you referred to was actually Mark King refereeing, our referee Mark King, who was refereeing really well, I thought. He stopped the match clock, and from that onwards, the production team, they give us the feed of the sound and the pictures of, and then we have a look on the monitors. It was the three of us, the marker, obviously Mark as the table referee, and I was there as the second referee on site to have a look as well. And we came to an agreement, was out of time, and we didn't really feel disturbed or anything by the crowd. We were just focused on our stuff, which worked really well. And I thought that also comes along because obviously now everyone has done it a few times. We are more experienced in that regard and we just switch it off and we can trust our abilities. And that's where it pays off in those incidents.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, fair do. Well, we'll focus a lot more on you in a moment. Just want to dot the I's and cross the T's a little bit, Phil, on as we normally do on some of the results. And I've actually got them from the last 16 onwards, just so we fill people on a little bit more on what happened. These are results from that stage. Tom Ford, 20. Ali Carter, 14. Julian Leclerc, 53. Juan Sidrun, 47. Dominic Dale beat Xiao Yulong, 72-0. It was Michael White, 50. David Grace, 9. Chris Wakelin, 38. Jack Jones, 35. Daniel Wells claimed a hard-fought win over Nopon Sankam, 50-36. It was Michael Holt, 47, Jack Lazowski, 38. Real heavyweight meeting, that one. Liam Highfield, 79, Dechuat Pumjiang, 3. And the quarterfinals, it was Daniel Wells beating Tom Ford, 57-16. Dominic Dale beating Liam Highfield, 75-32. Julian Leclerc beat the shootout expert. We all thought Michael might go all the way again, but Julian won that 30-23. It was Chris Wakelin, 42, Michael White, 22. And then the semi-finals, Chris Wakelin beat Daniel Wells, 46-23. And Julian Leclerc beat Dominic Dale, 98-8. Should say, terrific run from Dominic. We thought that might be a right old fairy tale at his age. Break of 58 from Leclerc in that. And then for the second year in a row, as I say, the final really wasn't a contest, but credit to the winner, a break of 119 from Wakelin, the highest break of the tournament. So, superb winner, superb event. Congratulations to everybody involved in the organising. I think we can all say, you know, I can see you nodding there, Phil. We'd love it, don't we? And as I say, I did see an idea, and I know we always say, oh no, you wouldn't want it more than once, but I did see a couple of people say, well, actually, it's so popular, could you almost make a week out of it, sort of some mini events, Phil? Have you got a word on that? And maybe its own system that feeds into a ranking winner, but in a more specific way. I thought there was some merit in that.
Yeah, maybe. I think there's scope for, I'd love to see it taken abroad. And yeah, we talk about sort of breaking new markets and stuff. If you did it over the summer in places where we don't have many events or any events, you know, throw a shootout in around Europe somewhere or, you know, wherever we can really, that might be a great way of getting new fans in. You know, you could have non-ranking versions or whatever, but yeah, I mean, I don't know how much you could, you don't want to push it too far, do you? Because I think the novelty value is a big part of it. But I think there's definitely scope for using it to break into new markets or developing markets for sure. I'd love to see it abroad.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. There's certainly scope for 3 or 4 extra days, I'd say, by the way. I don't feel after 4 days, oh, I can't do any more now. I actually almost could do with a few more. So there might be something in that. Marcel, we want to move a bit more onto specifically you now. Tell us about you growing up and how you sort of first fell in love with the game, as you so evidently are.
Yeah, as in your introduction, you mentioned I fell in love with the game on via Eurosport. I think it was 2005 when I first came across, and I just stopped on the channel, and I kind of like fall in love with the game. I believe the first game that I actually watched was during the World Championship. And I also believe that one of the players that was involved was Stephen Hendry. But I'm not 100% sure on that. I'm afraid. Unfortunately, you forget those things. And from that moment onward, I just kept watching. Unfortunately, from where I come from, I live in Berlin now since 2014. But before that, I came from a little village in the east part of Germany. But unfortunately, snooker tables aren't very popular there, and so the only exit I had access to a snooker table was in a casino, which I was only allowed to go in when I was 18, which is obviously a bit late if you really want to start playing snooker. But once I finished school, I was finally able to get there and finally play the game. Before that, I was only playing American pool, but then I finally played a bit of snooker. Never really picked a snooker up. I stick to American pool, but that's where I started. And in 2008, in fact, by coincidence, I came across a referee course, and I decided to attempt that one to become a local referee, basically. Without having the intention at all to become a professional referee, that just developed somehow. I can't actually tell you how it worked out. It just worked out over the years. But I attended that one and I really loved it. I wanted to do it to just find out more about the games, more about the rules, of course, because I just used that chance. And as it turned out, I really enjoyed it. I decided to attend more tournaments to gain more and more experience. Not long after that, I also attended our German championship, where I received my next referee certificate. And from that onwards, it wasn't long until I actually done my first World Snooker tournament, which was the 2010 PTC in Bruges. That was my very first event I did for World Snooker as a referee.
Who was your first ever match there?
Well, again, unfortunately, I'm not 100% sure, but one of the very first matches I refereed was Alan McManus and Stuart Bingham.
Oh, wow.
And I believe the first match before that was Martin O'Donnell and a player called David Singh, I think. He was involved, but other than that, I just cannot remember. It's a bit unfortunate. There are referees who write all those things down, but I just didn't do it. I kind of like regret nowadays because you can't answer those questions properly. But at least I know the tournament where it all started. It was October 2010.
And you progressed really quickly. Obviously, you were sort of setting records for the youngest referee to do certain things. Is that because the opportunities are there and you would encourage other people to do the same thing? Or is that just because you were so good, you could do it so quickly?
I believe it's kind of like a combination of a few things. Obviously, coming in too early, and then I just love the game. I love the job, even though I don't really call it a job, as I just enjoy it so much. I don't think many people actually are able to say that you are making a living out of your hobby, which is, I so appreciate that thing. It means so much to me. I never in my life I had a thought like, oh, I don't fancy going to work today, because it's just such a pleasure to be involved in that circuit, whether that's the snooker or the pool. It's just fantastic. And obviously, if you fall in love with something, you put every effort into it, and to develop, to gain experience, especially at the start, it is so important because bear in mind that you don't start right at the top. You've got to earn your stripes first. That's what I did. I traveled around the country, first in Germany, then also for the PTCs around Europe and stuff, because the conditions back then, not many people know that, weren't the same as they are now. Once those PTCs were developed, obviously more and more referees were required by World Snooker, but the tournaments that were promoted by the local promoter in, let's say, Germany, Poland, you name it. They were looking after us, but we weren't paid. We were receiving accommodation, food and stuff, but looking back, that's understandable because they want to kind of like develop the tournament, and we wanted to do it still to gain the experience. Especially, it was a great experience to gain experience for television. That was just a fantastic thing for us to gain this kind of experience and becoming more of a professional referee.
Well, that all makes total sense. You're obviously a very humble character. We can see that. But when did you kind of, how quickly was it that you realised, I'm actually good at this. I'm actually, you know, potentially really good. And how much input are you getting from people like Paul Collier, Jan Bahas? Are they saying things to you? Are they giving you encouraging noises early on? Some of those more senior refs?
That's how it works in general. Absolutely. Obviously, at the start of, let's call it refereeing career, when you start on a local basis, you're still receiving like comments from players. But nowadays, I learned that you shouldn't take too much of that too serious, because at the end of the day, they don't really know what really is important as a referee. It's still nice to hear, don't get me wrong. But those guys, Paul, Brendan, Olivier, Jan, they know what it's all about. They are our assessors at World Snooker. And they know what they need to tell you, what you need to look at, what you need to, what you, things you're doing right, things you're doing wrong. You've got to take this kind of stuff on board to progress.
That's interesting about the players. So you're sort of saying they think they might know a bit more than they do. What are they getting wrong? I imagine for them, it's where you're standing is the key thing, isn't it? And where,
maybe not so much the players, rather speaking, like in general. Like, let's put it this way: imagine a game where nothing basically goes wrong. You don't, as a referee, you just pick the balls out, call it the score, and at the end of the game, they just say, "Well done." Okay, yeah, but nothing really happened. And those situations where something actually happens, where you've got to intervene, where you've got to handle via your experience that you gained over the years, that those situations really matter from my perspective personally.
And you were saying about how the shootout, you sort of allow yourself a bit of a laugh with the crowd because it is funny, and the other tournaments obviously is super serious. Does that sort of just suit your personality, or do you have to almost go into refereeing mode where it's like it's serious time now?
Yeah, I think the way how I'm refereeing is pretty much how I am personally. People go on about that, how I style and stuff, but that's basically what I'm like. Really, I'm just a very, clean person. You find a better word for me. I'm quite accurate in all the things I do. Whether that is snooker or life in general, I'm quite organized, which is quite good skill for a referee, I assume. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
You've got a super professional look, which I think is very good a referee. I think I can talk about from me and Nick's point of view, and this is not a visual service, but we would not look suitable to referee a pub car park fight. you look ideal to referee, you know, super serious professional matches. So I think that is a good thing.
Oh, dear, brilliant. Well, you only hurt the ones you love, of course. And I should say, no, when Monica Sulkowska joined us, I made this point. I made other points as well. There are some things in life that I think I could probably try that, and I might not be good, but I'll have a go. Or some things I think I might be quite good. But refereeing, I know I'd have absolutely no chance. I might keep concentration for maybe the first half of the Reds, but then you'd be like, oh, God, what am I doing tonight? Oh, I've got to ring that guy, haven't I? I've got to do this. I just don't know. Actually, that takes me on to a question that I was going to ask a bit later, but maybe now. Your concentration, yourself and the collective body of referees, is extraordinary to someone like me, I have to say. Do you practice that in any way? I mean, I know we you know, something like meditation is now very popular in life. I'm not sure if it's something specifically like that, but maybe, you know, some kind of mindfulness in between. How do you, is it natural in you, and how much do you have to work at that?
I don't believe there's any meditation involved. I don't think any one of us does this kind of stuff. It's just another question of routine. Once you develop your refereeing routine, that's what you can rely on. That's where you get your confidence from. That's where you get all your skills from. Especially in situations where it matters, where things go wrong, you can always fall back. It's similar to players. When they are under pressure, they rely on their technique. They developed over their practice over the years, and we are kind of like the same. I mean, looking back, even like I'm not the same referee that I was 2 years ago. I can honestly say I developed to the good from, let's say, since I've done the world final, and this is how it works. You progress every match, every tournament, and that's how you become more and more relaxed, and that's obviously, over the time, you find out, you can figure out where are the times where you don't need to be like 100% on the spot. There are moments during a snooker match where you don't need to be 100% focused on every single position. There's just no need. Obviously, that's ideal, but because no one is a robot, I assume. And therefore, there are those little moments. But it's important, of course, that you are aware that anything can happen at any moment, and there are, of course, situations where you're getting caught out. Every one of us had the situation where this happens, where you're just getting caught out. Let's say there's a situation on the table where it's nowhere, you would never guess that the player would have missed that shot. So you've got to award foul and a miss. Other player says, put it back, and you've got to hold your hand up and say, well, I've got no idea where the ball was. And obviously, that's where we're getting called out. But those things are just the nature of the game, and it just happens. And then in those situations, as I described it, we would need to work together. But it's just how it is, I assume.
Well, we should say that you are hearing quite a lot of noise at the moment. I mean, could you tell those guys in the background that Nick Metcalf and Phil Haig are recording a podcast? No, that might help.
Oh, honestly.
No, not at all. No, we are keeping it real. We are keeping it real. It is the noises of the setting up of the World Pool Championship in the background. Not at all. It's one of those things. As I say, it's a good symbol of how busy you guys are. You're off one event, off to the next. I want to ask you something else, actually, as well, about maybe those early days. You say you don't remember specific matches, but do you remember when you were first recognised by somebody that said, did I see you on the telly?
I don't think I remember the first time, but over the years it happens here and there. Actually, I was recognised on the plane twice. Then on the German underground, I was recognised, which is obviously quite a nice feeling, of course, yeah. Yeah. Then usually it happens in the environment of Q Sports, like I'd say in the club that I play. It's not a members club, it's an open club, and people coming in, and sometimes they recognize you and they bring it up. But it's always a nice feeling, of course, yeah.
That's interesting what you were saying there about how referees develop, and that must be just, you know, experience, because how often does something crop up in a match that you haven't seen before, even if it's just sort of a little difference, but that's the only years of doing it will let you learn more and more sort of situations that aren't normal.
Yeah, that's the thing. When you take every referee in one group, you kind of tend to say, we've seen everything, but still, every now and again, something happens you just can't make up. It's just unbelievable. That's why it's just one part of the game that why we love it. I think all of us. It's just unpredictable, and those situations play a part in it.
Well, that all makes sense, yeah. We want to ask, obviously, you're starting to do the big events. It must be a great thrill. It must be very exciting. What was it like the first time you refereed at the Crucible? The build-up to it when you found out? Had you been to the Crucible before, watching other years? I don't know, maybe you'd marked there before you refereed. I'm not sure, you tell us. And just how exciting was it, and how much of a sort of career high was it?
It was very special. In fact, I still remember the feeling when I first received that letter saying and informing me about the number of days that I was going to referee. That 2015 it was when I first refereed there, and I've never been to the Crucible before. I've been to Sheffield before, but I've never put a foot into the Crucible, into the building, never before. And the rigging day, just before the first final day, I'm sorry about the sound in the background. I think they're putting some pipes together. I don't know what they're doing. Sorry. And and I still remember on that first rigging day, just before the Saturday of the first day of play, when I walked into the auditorium and I asked, I think it was Jan Verhaas who asked to take a picture of me standing in the middle of the arena, and I still got that picture from that moment. And yeah, as you can imagine, for us referees as well, this is the thing you want to do. The Crucible, the World Championship, that's the event you want to be on. It's just the pinnacle of a referee's career, I think.
The way the players talk about the Crucible is, especially in the two-table setup, they're always shocked how sort of tight it is, and you feel like the audience is almost can touch you. They literally can sometimes, I think. Did that feel sort of quite oppressive as a referee as well?
Absolutely. During the first couple of weeks where we got the two-table set up in place, it's difficult for us as well, as we cannot get into a position where we are ideally placed, as it's just too tight around the table. You've got to be very on the board, on the ball, to get into the position where, kind of like getting out of the player's island, that's the main thing. But as it is just the nature of the Crucible, it is just not possible. So you've got to kind of like adjust your position. But that's just how it is. Everyone knows that. Players know, are aware of it. And so that's just the way it is. But still, it makes it so special as well at the same time, I think.
Did anyone sort of, I mean, you probably knew that anyway, but did anyone sort of give you any tips or anything? Because I imagine if that was your first World Championship game and you're in a situation where you're taking up different positions you wouldn't normally take, it would be, you know, really easy to lose concentration in that situation.
Of course, absolutely. No, I think everyone's receiving a little chat before their first time when doing this event. But bear in mind, this is the pinnacle. So therefore, you earned your stripes before you get there. So you know what you're doing. That's the thing you got to keep in mind. All the matches you've done in the past, that's your preparation for this occasion. And you can feel it as well. The butterflies, I remember back then they came to me at some stage. They were gone after the final ball was struck, but still they were there. That's a nice feeling, I tell you.
And it was that year as well. It was your first major sort of ranking final in Germany as well, wasn't it? I mean, the Tempodrome, we hear so much about it. What an atmosphere that must have been.
Correct. Yeah, 2015, first major final. Sean Murphy, Mark Selby, if I can remember correctly. Fantastic experience, fantastic occasion, especially doing it in my hometown. It's just unique. And the Tempodrome itself, the one table in the middle with 2,500, just cheering you on. Tempodrome is quite special for us as well, as we get the opportunity to get a proper walk-in for us referees. And it's just not just for the final, actually, it is not just a short walk-in from basically Marcus desk to the table. It's restarting. You're doing the same walk as the players do from the top of the stairs. It takes you around 50, 60 seconds. And the crowd just doesn't stop clapping and cheering. It's a fantastic proper goosebump at that moment. Yeah, no, I still remember it. And I'm so feeling so privileged that I had that opportunity over the years, quite a few times now. And I think everyone should do it at some stage, same as the Crucible. I wish everyone could do and have that experience. Just for the sake of it, yeah.
Well, we want to ask you a bit more about the German Masters and the Tempodrome coming up, because of course the tournament is coming up. But just back to the Crucible, of course, you then got established during the tournament there. You got your first final in 2020. very unusual tournament because of COVID. I guess you were delighted, were you? I mean, obviously health came first, but were you delighted when you heard there'd be fans at the final? I mean, I still think it would have been a great honour for you, but would it have taken it away a little bit had it been empty?
Yeah, it was a very odd year, wasn't it, for all of us? But regarding the World Championship, yeah, I did, usually you find out whether you're doing the World Championship finally find around like 2 or 3 months before. But in that year, in fact, I only found out once I was tested negative when I arrived at the World Qualifiers. So that was just before the World Championship main event. And from that moment onwards, of course, you were thinking about, well, is it going to be the same? Of course, it's not going to be the same with COVID around. But still, it was such a nice feeling to know that they, in the end, they decided to have, I think it was a 50% capacity for the final, which made a big difference for the players, especially as I think I've been there as a marker for the semis, and everyone remembers it. Those two semifinals in that year, which was Ronnie against Mark and Sydney against Kyvin, everyone remembers those matches. But imagine what kind of matches they would have been with a crowd involved.
Mm. Yeah,
no, of course, it would have made a difference. Yeah, of course.
Of course, I mean that was just generally a very, very tough time, wasn't it? I mean, but I guess as we all said, we knew it already, but it crystallised it in our mind just how important fans are in this sport and how it, you know, it was still an okay product. Let's be clear, we watched it on television, but they really are the lifeblood, aren't they, of any sport really, but certainly of snooker. Without them, we just, I think, as a sport, got through it, didn't we, really? Rather than really enjoy it, we kind of just got through things.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to the shootout, we had a shootout without a crowd in Milton Keynes, and that wasn't a shootout, was it? It's just that the entertainment product is in combination with the fans, and that's what it's all about from my point of view.
It must be similar for referees as players. When I speak to sort of lower ranked players who spend a lot of the time playing matches in cubicles in Barnsley and Wigan and places, and you know, you professionally go and do it, but it's nothing like the buzz of playing in front of a crowd on TV. And I guess similar feelings for officials.
Absolutely. No, it makes a big difference. Obviously, you're getting used to it at some stage, but you're still kind of like thinking about it as it is, as they are involved you, as it is involved in your work. You need to, having a crowd there give you kind of like more to do, more to focus on. And same to the players, I assume. As you've got to look out for whether people are behaving, whether they are moving, even shouting out some sort of things that they shouldn't do, and not finding the timing to cheer on the players. And those are the things we need to look at. Mm. But it's also at the same point, without them, it wouldn't be the same.
Mm. Yeah, and well, I think we, as I mentioned, we go back to Germany. I think probably like to now, actually, German Masters coming up. Tell us about how the game has grown there in recent times. I know Eurosport's been a big influence. I mean, people genuinely love the game there, don't they? There's a real kind of love affair that they really embrace it. There's a real kind of enthusiastic fan base.
Absolutely. The fan base is quite fantastic, I think, probably second to none. However, from a player's perspective, there aren't many players, unfortunately. Germany is a massive snooker country regarding TV audience, but probably not for players, unfortunately, because there aren't many in comparison, especially to the UK. The numbers are just so low. I think, don't quote me on that, but I think we have allowed, I think less than 5,000 players in total, probably a lot less even. That's just not, you can't get, you need the numbers to find a player. And but so we should be more, even more appreciate the numbers that we got with the audience that do decide to come and watch to the venues. Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure in the biggest cities there are, you know, quite a few tables dotted around here and there, but you mentioned growing up and maybe in some of the, you know, smaller regions or, you know, less, not the, the first and foremost cities, is probably at, it's not as accessible as you'd like it to be, is it?
No, not at all. Obviously, we got quite a lot American pool clubs. It's easy to get access to those tables, or in the east part especially, we've got cavern tables, which is quite popular just because of the nature of how everything, the history, how everything developed. American pool was kind of like, the access to those tables is easier, and the, you've got to take a look into the brighter side of the bigger picture for the owners of those clubs or bars, because he knows it's just more expensive for them to put a snooker table up. It's similar to the UK now, nowadays, where those locations deciding to take those tables down to instead of one table, they're putting in two pool tables and basically double their money. And that's just has an impact on the number of players. Therefore, if you haven't got the opportunity to play the game, you can't progress any further, can you? And that's just one downside. And Germany, at the moment, we've got one professional. Last few years, we had a couple. But other than that, it's just tough to see someone really coming through. And obviously, becoming professional is one thing, but then proper staying on tour and make a proper living out of it is a completely different world. And unfortunately, that's one thing that really can do better in Germany as well. Who's, I wouldn't blame anyone, definitely not the TV, because the TV has, can't think of many other sports that have such a high amount of days throughout the year that is just showing that's your, that sport. But if people haven't got the opportunity to play it, try it out, it's just hindering, isn't it?
What sort of level are we talking in terms of popularity? Is there sort of just a big snooker community, or would sort of regular sports fans, would they know about snooker as well?
I think you could feel it. If you would have asked someone on the streets, do you know what snooker is in Germany, let's say 20 years ago, that you probably 1 in 20 would know what you're talking about. Nowadays, every chance people know what snooker is, which is a fantastic development in itself. And yeah, it's definitely growing, but in players playing wise, I'm not so sure. I think when I have a look on who's playing, who won the German championship, who is winning those league matches and stuff, the same players for years and ages. Clubs are dying, unfortunately. They don't live for that long anymore. That's just how it is. I mean, they've still got like series and stuff on the place, but it's kind of like, doesn't give the feeling that it's going anywhere better, that it's not going any positive, I believe.
It's a shame, because if someone did spring up and it's like a natural talent, it sounds like there would be a huge superstar over there.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But I mean, German fans are just so enthusiastic when you see them, obviously taking into context and still quite new for them, and they don't have the opportunity as you have in the UK to have a tournament every month, let's say, that you can attend. It's something very special in Germany, as you only get the German Masters and the European Masters, or the Polar Classic, as it was called in the past, in third, if I learned that. And yeah, it's something special, and the audience really does appreciate it, I think. Everyone can feel that, players feel that, and we feel it as well as referees.
Mm-hmm. And we should say, Phil Hague, that the German Masters looks very open, doesn't it? Lots of stars have not made it. I mean, I've picked out a few matches. Neil Robertson against Joe Perry, our old friends there. Chris Wakelin just won the shootout playing C. Twyhee. Jimmy White, may have heard of him. He's playing Penny Song. Jimmy may fancy himself getting further down the road. But looking at the draw, we mentioned before what a shame it is actually, Phil, for the German crowds. But what an opportunity opening up potentially for one of the more unfashionable players on tour to have a really good run.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's sort of anybody's game there. So many top 16 players fell in qualifying. Then we've obviously had like Zhao Xingtong got through and he's suspended clearly. So yeah, it's extremely open. Neil Robertson in there, the big name, but you know he's got a tough one straight up against Joe Perry. So yeah, it really could be an unusual name on the trophy or certainly in the finals. Lisowski's in there. This could be his time finally to end that endless conversation about when his first ranking title will come. But yeah, so anyone heading to Berlin will see it as a superb opportunity. And if not to get the title, but at least to go and play in that one table atmosphere that is so famous.
Oh, absolutely. And we enjoy the tournament, everybody, coming up. Now, let's move the story with you, Marcel, onto the Masters. Now, we've done about 40, maybe 45 minutes. What subject have we not come to yet? Now, I don't know if you're guessing it. We've had loads and loads of correspondence. Something quite pesky that made itself a bit of a himself or herself what's the gender, aren't they? Bit of a nuisance of themselves at the Masters. The Wasp. Now that has to rank as one of the funniest incidents seen in snooker for quite some time. I don't know. I also think what's the funniest bit? Was it the Mark Williams incredible one man routine, the old ho 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 and all that? Or was it you whacking the camera? I think it's you whacking the camera person. I mean, what are you thinking when this is all going on? Are you seeing the funny side or are you frankly thinking this is a nightmare?
Kind of both, I assume. But our cameraman, Daryl, God bless him, he was just like standing there like a stone, wasn't he? He didn't move because the thing was that was, or whatever it was just so massive. It was just unbelievable. And first, obviously, it was flying around the table, landing on Mark and all sorts of places. And then it decided to go nearby our cameraman. And it actually ended up in the inside of his collar, of his shirt. And that made it even worse. And obviously, in that just before it went in there, I wanted to stop that thing from going in there. So I slapped him, asked him to not move, which he did. And yeah, then, but it still decided to walk in there. And then luckily it didn't stung him and flew away eventually. And yeah, but the next day I heard it was found on the table in a not so moving state anymore.
Well, yeah, this is another Talking Snooker exclusive. Sorry. The Wasp, I'm doing the sign of the cross as a good Catholic boy. Are you saying the Wasp was no more?
I think it wasn't moving anymore, so yeah.
It seems to be a problem every year now. The Ali Pali seems to be Wasp central, because at the darts as well, there's often the Ali Pali Wasp. So yeah, it's a unique challenge.
It's quite an old building, I think, isn't it? And in combination with all the beer from the darts, I think it's not a good combination to keep the Wasp away, I think. we have them every year. So they are kind of like a guest without a ticket nowadays, aren't they?
We've had loads of correspondence. We should say our friend Shadnam Yunus Jewell from the BBC. Do you know any good ways of getting rid of Wasps?
Well, I mean, obviously not, no.
The serious point of that, of course, is that no one really knows any good way of getting rid of Wasps. I mean, I've always been a bit of a Stephen Hendry. I can't bear them. So that thing about standing, you know, standing or sitting still, not at all. I'm running a mile, which, of course, then makes them more annoyed. They start getting angry and it all then gets even worse. But no, that they sting and they hurt. So that's the bottom line. It's no laughing matter. But, of course, when you're in the middle of 2,000 people, and you're on television, it kind of is a laughing matter, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't practice those things, can you? It just happens at the time. Just aren't prepared for this kind of stuff. You just got to act how it's you think is the right way to do it. Yeah, can't practice it.
Yeah. Phil, should we move on to some correspondence? We've had loads, haven't we?
Yeah, let's do it.
We should say you are listening here to Talking Snooker with Phil Hague and Nick Metcalf, and our special guest at the World Pool Championship is Marcel Eckhart, one of the game's top referees. Now, we've got Irene Sriharan here on email. I met at the Masters. Might vie with Brian Campbell for our nicest fan, possibly, Phil. She says, I am very excited to hear from Marcel. He has great table presence and just glides around the table and moves with the players in such an elegant and beautiful way. He makes refereeing look like an art form, like a ballet dancer. Very interested to hear his thoughts on the dynamic between players and referees. How many times have you been likened to a ballet dancer, Marcel?
Never, but still, I think, thank you so much for that introduction. I really loved it. Loved it earlier, and this one is just thank you for the compliment. No, I love to hear that. And no, but obviously, when the player's on a break, it kind of like I assume it is, feels like a dance, in fact, as we are got our routines as the players playing from this side, so you're walking into that side, and that's just how it works. And it's kind of, it is like a routine, really. And that's how, yeah, that's how it works. It's kind of like a good feeling as well, especially if the player is on a big break. I don't really know what else to say.
There wasn't really a question.
Strike by the compliment, really.
Yeah, that was lovely. I think we can move on to Suzanne on email. It's hi, Phil, and hi, Nick. When our German referee Marcel joins the podcast, could you ask him whether he has a favourite player? If yes, I do not want to ask who it is. I just would like to know whether he has ever been in the situation that he was a referee at a match of his favourite player and how difficult that was, as he has to be a neutral as a referee. Thank you and best regards.
Let's put it this way, I never had an issue.
Okay.
No, exactly. Exactly. We're all human. We all have our... It's a bit like us as journalists, isn't it, really? We sort of don't really care who wins, frankly, do we?
No, and it just doesn't make any difference for us, really, who wins or who doesn't. It doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, we're there to do a job. That's what we do. We don't really... It doesn't make... We don't have any advantage of one guy winning or one guy losing. It just doesn't matter to us. But therefore, we are in a position to be as neutral as possible. And I think every one of us are.
We've got Rob Francis, the aforementioned Rob Francis, on Twitter. What a brilliant guest for the podcast. Marcel has refereed both of the maximum breaks I've seen live.
Told you.
I'd like to ask... Sorry?
Told you. I mentioned it earlier.
Oh, you did. That's right. I'd like to... Very good. Yes, I'd like to ask... This isn't just thrown together, is it, Phil? Well, it is actually. But and I'd like to ask at what point it is that he starts to get the rush of excitement over the possibility of one being made. How many reds have gone down when you're thinking, wait a minute?
It depends. Sometimes I've had a couple where I thought right at the first red because the balls were just there. Other maximums, obviously, it depends on how the setup of the table is. Usually you've got one or at least a couple of reds where they are usually in an awkward situation, an awkward position. And there you could just need to wait until the player comes to that part where it's usually around 113 or 5 or something. And then you get in the proper excitement. But yes, sometimes, in fact, as the players do, we once a couple of reds are down, you can see it. And you can see quite early whether he's going for a certain shot or not. And then you see his intention and you can feel it. Definitely.
This is Lorenzo Twitter, the next question. And it sort of feeds into it because you're obviously doing a job, but you are a Suka fan. You must like watching these amazing things. And Lorenzo's question was, one I always wonder, as a referee, when they witness an amazing shot up close, do you ever have to fight the urge to clap?
No, I never did. I might have raised my eyebrows here and there. But of course, you know, especially if there's a funny shot or something, you just sometimes you just can't help it and put a smile on or... but that's just how it is, right? Yeah, of course. As we said earlier, we're all humans and no robots. But though we are quite concentrated, and I think that helps to keep our emotions down. And also we are kind of like expected to be neutral. So even like those little smiles that just might have come across a bit strange, I would say. And so therefore we try to avoid those. Absolutely, yeah.
Neil Caesar on email, what is the rule regarding players leaving the table after frames? This seems to have gotten worse over the years. Keep up the great work on the podcast. What's the rules?
I don't think it was getting worse over the days. I don't share that opinion, to be honest. But the rule is basically, if the players are allowed to leave, once the match has started, players are only allowed to leave the table for a toilet break or to fetch some water, and that's it. If they're not permitted any cigarette breaks or check their phones and stuff, we're not having that. That's not part of the match. And yeah, and if a player wants to go to the toilet or wants to go to see the restroom, we cannot stop them. It's just not possible. It's against human rights, basically. If you would put a rule in, you kind of like see where this is going to head. It's what not, you know, wouldn't end well, I assume. You will never be able to stop players from going to the toilet. However, I don't think it's an issue, as it usually takes up until about 90 seconds to set up the table again. And I also think it's kind of like nature of the game that, especially after a longer frame or even a short frame, the player wants to walk out for a second. He goes to the restroom but wants to focus himself again, and it's just part of it. I don't think it's a big issue from a personal point of view. But that's players are allowed toilet break, and that's it.
John on Twitter here. Ronnie O'Sullivan often seems to give you challenges and make life difficult for you. Don't know if that's true or not. What's it like having to deal with Ronnie?
I don't really think we have any issues together. There was it's kind of like made up. I assume there was one minor incident years ago, like talking 2014 or 15, I think. There was one situation where I had to get the ping out of the center pocket, out of the middle pocket. And he kind of like had to play from there the next shot. And there wasn't much room for me to get the ball out. And he kind of like afterwards, unfortunately, gave an interview where he didn't praise me. But from that onwards, we moved on. The next match, and a couple of days afterwards, he was the complete opposite to me. Afterwards, he came to me and said like, oh, so much better today, praised me before, he praised me afterwards, and that's just it. But of course, Ronnie is a special character, and from a referee's point of view, of course, it puts a bit more pressure on you, but especially because when he plays, of course, there's usually a big audience, a big crowd, more focused, and again, as more often you do those kind of matches, you feel more relaxed. It's easier to ref those matches, but yeah, that's what it is. But there's no issue with him. We're getting on quite well, and especially at the table. Other than that, I've got nothing to do with him, and I'm good with that. No. Mm-hmm. I respect him as a player. I think he respects me as a referee, and nothing else to say, really. Yeah.
Do you, not just Ronnie, but Ronnie's an example of just a quick player, are you aware of who you're reffing in particular and would speed up a bit to get balls out of pockets because it's a certain player?
Absolutely. I think it's part of the game that you need to adjust your speed, your positioning. You need to take certain things in context, where you stand, how you handle certain players. Absolutely, it all plays a part. Mm-hmm. And you learn this over the years. Again, it's often more time to do those players. You pick up on certain things they like, they dislike. There are certain players they don't even like that you taking the rest of them. They rather prefer to put it back themselves. And that these are the things you need to remember once you have to referee those players. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Davey, I think, is next here on Twitter. I don't remember this actually, but take Jonathan's word for it. In the Masters, the referee called for a replay to check for a jump shot. In what circumstances can and should a shot be referred to a replay? Almost, we'd say snooker's equivalent of the VAR in football. Can you use it? When can you use it?
Yeah, that referee was actually me. That was a situation where the player miscued, and the cue ball, it wasn't a jump shot in the end, which our replay system proved. And it actually is a rule that you can use this kind of footage if available. And that's the rule. If available, you can use it. If there's any doubt, the referee decides. Also, you've got to bear in mind that it's completely up to the referee to use this kind of facilities. It's not up to the players. They can ask for it, but the referee is going to make the decision whether we're actually going to use it. And then in those instances, it's always up to the referee to have a look and make a decision. And sometimes it doesn't even help. It makes it even more difficult to use this kind of footage. It's just funny, isn't it? As you know from other sports as well.
Yeah, that's true.
I think if the technology is available, why not use it for the benefit? I mean, for that little example of the jump shot, it would have been a foul otherwise, and it might have had an impact on the frame score in the end. And it would be just a shame if it turns out afterwards it would have been a foul, and those points were not awarded to the opponent, and would it make a difference in the end? Nowadays, if you got the opportunity in the technology, why not using it? I don't see the disadvantage on it.
Yeah, agreed.
Players playing for a lot of money, and everyone wants to make the right call.
Yeah. Andy on Twitter here. This might be a tricky one because you got into it so early, but if not a professional referee, what would you be doing as a career now?
I honestly have no idea. as I said earlier, I just feel so lucky to be involved in that scene, in that whole circuit. And I assume what else would I have done? I think maybe some normal daytime office job. I think just some admin work. This kind of stuff, probably, as I'm kind of like into admin administration things. I can see me there, probably. Yeah, something behind a desk, behind a laptop, probably.
Chris Lee on Twitter asks, what are your hobbies outside snooker?
I play pool, American pool. That's a circuit sport, but other than that, when I'm at home, I'm not in the tournament, I kind of like feel like I just enjoy being at home. Just enjoy that moment, and there I just into streaming. I love playing the PlayStation. Mm. I also go out, enjoy Berlin. Berlin is a perfect place to be around, to enjoy yourself. And what else? We go on holiday. Quite a big holiday every year we try to, and so I love that, traveling around the world, all the places that I don't see or I have seen on my journeys for when I travel around for referee. Just a few stuff I assume. I also kind of like into I try to keep him up with the general news. I consider myself in quite a good general knowledge, and obviously there I'm reading the news, this kind of stuff, just normal stuff, I assume. Yeah.
You mentioned traveling now. I was looking at your list of ranking finals, and even just those finals, you've been all over the place, the Indian Open and the European Masters in Romania. I wondered, where's the most sort of unusual place you've refereed?
Let me think about that. Unusual place. Barnsley? No. I don't know. Unusual place. No, I can't think of anything unusual. I love every place. I said it, yeah. Benidorm in Australia was fantastic. I thought it was quite, because it was only the one occasion, I kept that in mind. Other than that, nothing really unusual. No, I don't think.
I remember seeing the pictures from that Austria tournament. It looked beautiful.
Yeah. Australia.
I mean, Australia.
Yeah.
Oh, the goldfield. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not Benidorm. What I'm thinking of Benidorm. No, sorry. Bendigo. What am I saying?
You said Benidorm. You've got Paul Collier on your mind. He's often going to Benidorm.
Yeah, probably.
I'll have to get Paul Collier on here one day, of course, as well. I'm going to ask you a little bit of a tougher one. I've got to couch this a bit carefully. I don't want to talk specifically about a free ball incident we saw recently. I think we all saw how long it went on for. But it just seems to be maybe a hint that players are challenging referees. I don't know if it's more than they used to, but there seems to be sometimes they will push a little bit. It's important for referees to be strong, isn't it? And are you sensing sometimes that players are getting a bit too, not big for their boots, that's not quite right, but are they getting a bit too involved when actually the referee's word should be final?
So you can excuse me, it's kind of like a daily politics or a daily incident that happens. I'm going to make a comment regarding that specific incident. However, I think, as I mentioned earlier, players playing for quite a bit of money, and I don't think anyone really intends to get under anyone's skin. Everyone just wants to have the right decision, and that's just the main thing. I can't think of anyone having the intention just for his advantage. If that player thinks that's the situation, it is a free ball or not a free ball, then he's doing that because he really thinks that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the referee, yes, is in sole charge. He's the one who's having the final word. And there are, just because of the nature of the game, there are situations where opinions might divide, and that's just how it is. Yeah, but again, once you've been in such a situation where you might have struggled, next time you're gonna 100%, you're gonna make it a lot better. And I've been there, everyone else has been there. It's just how it is, that you learn from it. And if something like this happens with a big audience, that's just how it is. But that's just the nature of the game. I don't think it's a big deal, really.
Yeah,
everyone's got to learn at some stage. And that's just how it is.
Yeah, it's like we said before about the gaining experience is the only way to do it, really. You can't read it in a book all the time. I was wondering, you completed your personal triple crown at the Masters, which is an amazing achievement. So you've ticked off an awful lot of boxes. Are there things that you still for aiming for in your career that you want to do that you haven't done yet?
Reffing the shootout final. Nah. Yeah. I haven't done that one. No, but on a serious note, I think completing the Triple Crown was probably a bigger achievement than refereeing the World Championship final alone, taking away the circumstances we talked about earlier. But that week at the Masters was just fantastic for myself, from an individual point of view. Just so many times I just felt at the table so good because of the occasion. I really, really enjoyed myself throughout the whole week. Just an amazing feeling, as I'm very much aware of what it means to a snooker referee, as not many have completed that Triple Crown as a referee. I was only the eighth, in fact, which is amazing, I think. Mm. Yeah.
No, it's a marvellous achievement. You should be very proud of it.
Thank you.
You all seem to get on brilliantly as referees. I mean, when I go at tournaments, I see you sometimes, you're chatting away and, you know, often about rules. Is it true that when you go out for an evening, I'm not saying you don't have any other interests, of course you do, but will you sometimes talk through the minutiae of rules on the night out?
It happens. Yeah, it happens. although we try to have it done, speak about it, and then move on to the next topic, which is less snooker or cue sport related. No, absolutely. But you don't have to talk about it. That's what you learn from. Also, from over the years, you got to take everything in context. I mean, the reason why the skills in referees nowadays is so good is because you learn from mistakes from the past. That's how it works. If you see something, let's say from 2005, you know how it was handled back then. Therefore, you can put it into your routine so you know how it's going to work. So you don't need to have to make that mistake yourself to know how to handle it. And those conversations, they just help. If you talk about certain rules where you might have thought you're quite certain how it is handled, but then you might realize, oh, hang on, no, it's not. And that's where you learn, absolutely. But we try to keep it to a minimum. Don't make it like a whole day snooker nonstop. It's a part of it, definitely. But you also need to find time to relax once the final ball went down.
Well, that's all makes sense. And you really have been a marvelous guest. You seem like someone that would just want, Phil's already talked about, you know, kind of ambitions left, but I can see you doing this long, long into the future. You haven't got any other sort of dream careers you want to spin off and doing. You're going to be one of those very long standing refs, are you?
I'm still enjoying myself every day. As I said earlier, I don't see myself finishing stopping refereeing at any point. Now I'm being more involved with the Metro 9 ball as well, which is an amazing addition to my calendar as well, as it's a bit different to the snooker scene, but amazing. And I've also picked up a few different roles there. I'm not just refereeing at those events. As you can hear in the background, I'm involved in the rigging and setting up tournaments, and which I also very much enjoy. It's fantastic. And I definitely see myself in the snooker scene, in the pool scene for many, many years left. No, guaranteed.
Well, you've been an absolutely marvellous guest. We can't thank you enough. And will you come back and see us again one day? Even if you refereed 4 or 5 world finals and you get massive, you won't forget us, will you?
Definitely. No, I promise. I will be back once you invite me again. No, I really, really enjoyed it, guys. I can't thank you enough. And yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll see you in Sheffield, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. Thanks, guys. Enjoy yourself and all the best.
Cheers, Marcel.
Take care. Thank you.
All the best to you. Terrific guest that was, Phil, wasn't it? Marcel Eckhart, one of the best referees in the game, and so many different insights there. And we had to say sorry about the noise, don't we? It did impinge on it, no question. At times, one of those things. Marcel did find a room there, but listen, I've been around rigging at tournaments, and you could be three or four walls removed, and you hear that stuff. It's absolutely massive. So, listen, I mean, we might fiddle around with it a bit, but I don't fancy the chances of getting rid of that background. Not with our technophobia, anyway. But anyway, it was a bit of a shame with some of the answers. But I think, you know, I hope people have got the gist of just what a great guest he was. And it's like, what a nice guy! Bloody hell! They don't make them as nice as that very often.
Yeah, he's been very generous with his time. And yeah, hopefully you got all the words there. We could hear it, but yeah, I mean, not ideal. It's amazing the amounts of metal they find to sort of bang into each other when they're setting things up, but it happens. So apologies. But yeah, no, great. I think he's just, as I sort of was saying, he's just got such a aura about him as an official. He's very sort of trustworthy, isn't he? Everyone's got, he's got a lot of respect for him. And yeah, superb guest.
Well, and a tremendous awe for his age. I mean, goodness me, some of the guys, you know, they're sort of 10, 15, 20 years older until they get that kind of, shall I say it, that gravitas around the table. But he sort of, yeah, had it almost from the start, actually, and certainly has got it now in many, many ways. Phil, we're going to shoot off soon. Maybe this is any other business for us. The classic returning. I don't think Mercantile Credit are going to be sponsoring it. A few people suggested. I don't think so. But they found the tournament. It's decent prize money. It's good news. It's in Leicester. Doesn't really matter where it is, to be honest. I know flippantly said about Milton Keynes last time. That's not really the factor here. The factor is money, opportunity, and, you know, it fills that gap in March where, as we were saying, it looked like slim pickings. I know Stephen Maguire's had some quite strong words to say to you, and I think WST... a little bit pointed back with their statement.
They were a little bit, yeah. It was, I spoke to Stephen at the shootout. I went down on the Wednesday, and he went on quite a rant about the game. And it was, I spoke to him and a piece with Anthony Hamilton as well, sort of between when the Turkish got cancelled and the Classic got announced. And you know, at that point, it looked very much like they were going to have a long old gap between any matches, really. I mean, Anthony hadn't qualified for Germany or Wales, so it looked like he had sort of 10, 11 weeks without playing. So, yeah, the Classic coming in is very good news. It's just, it's funny days, actually. I think it's running sort of a Friday to a... What was it? Friday or Wednesday or something? It's not finishing on a weekend. But anyway, like you said, yeah, it's good prize, sort of home nations level prize money and just the opportunity to play. So that was very good news. I think what the problem was and allowed for those sort of headlines to came out in between, it's just a communication issue. I think obviously they would have done it in a perfect world, but if somehow they could have aligned those announcements, so Turkey got cancelled and immediately it was like, but we've got the Classic. And there wasn't just a few days in between for players to be very annoyed about things, then it would have been so much better for World Snooker, I think. But yeah, so that is often the way in this sport. I think the communication is not quite up to par. But yeah, good that they've got a replacement. And we'll see how it goes. Yeah, they didn't announce how to watch or if there's going to be crowds yet, but the players have got a decent tournament to play in for good prize money. So that's the positive.
Yeah, I felt it kind of got a bit passive aggressive on both sides, if I'm honest. Well, if you can't put a Solomon on, where are we always going to? And it's you're right. Maybe he had a bit more closely aligned. That's frankly a nice way of saying it. That would have been probably better. But yeah, we do look forward to that. Germany coming up, of course. And, you know, that's going to be a smashing tournament. Jordan Brown with us in a couple of weeks. We had a couple of good questions in. We'd like more, please, for Jordan Brown as that appearance from him on here approaches. TalkingSnooker@yahoo.com or tweet us at TalkingSnooker. You spoke to Lazowski as well, didn't you? Is that since we last on there? I think it was. Yeah. Games, accusations of gamesmanship, players playing a bit slowly. I mean, is there much in that?
It's interesting that, wasn't it? Because he just played at the Shootout, so it was a funny time to sort of be speaking about that. But I think he was clearly still a bit irked by the game at the Grand Prix. I did say, "Are you talking about the game?" And he said, "I'm not saying anything." But I think it was quite obvious he was talking about that. It's a tricky one. Yeah, it probably is gamesmanship, isn't it? But that's not breaking the rules, and I guess if you sort of publicly complain about that, it's not going to stop it. It's probably going to make it worse. So that's the problem. But, that's what Jack thought. I always like talking to Jack. He's always got interesting things to say. You might not agree with him, but that's fine. He was talking, other than that, he was talking very positively about how he's enjoying his snooker, playing well. He's loving this link up with Ebden. So, yeah, we mentioned this very open field in Germany. It wouldn't be a big surprise at all if that was his breakthrough tournament.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people will be looking at that as a possibility. As you say, Neil Robertson in there as well. But, you know, Neil's having a sort of funny season at the moment. Very unusual to have not won a tournament by this stage for him. Mm-hmm. So he might start to feel a little bit of pressure, right? But again, he'll see it opening up type thing.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not one to panic, is he? I think he'll be fine. But, it's been... it was sort of fine for the first... He was getting to a lot of semis, wasn't he? And there was two or three tournaments where he got to the last four and you thought, oh, Neil's nailed on to win this. But then didn't. But yeah, he's not going to be panicking. He's been under the weather, so hopefully he's back to good health. And yeah, you certainly wouldn't be betting against him winning that tournament.
Definitely not. We've had lots of correspondence in, by the way, quite a bit about the Grand Prix and the Shootout, but we're not going to do that now. We're going to leave that for next time. We are going to come to it, though. Got a few people and that sort of stuff that we love as well, where they're very specifically going into what's good about the Shootout experience. And most of it's very, very positive, actually, in terms of facilities there, just how much people enjoy it. A bit about the Grand Prix as well, so we'll come to that next time. And I think that's probably about it, isn't it? It feels like this has been a long, long old episode, but great fun.
Yeah, I think that is it. There's probably some news that we've missed there, but I don't know. It's Germany starts on Wednesday, is it? So that'll be, we said it's almost, it's not like the Shootout, but in terms of the opportunity for players, there are going to be people going there thinking, I've got a real good chance. So it's going to be an interesting watch for that reason. Shame for the fans over there that not got so many of the top players going, but it makes it interesting another way. So yeah, enjoy that.
Indeed. And I'll see you next time. We'll be along to review that, won't we? And then we'll look ahead to the Welsh with Jordan Brown. We've got loads of great tournaments coming up. Very exciting time of the season, of course. TalkingSnooker@yahoo.com is the way to contact us, or tweet us at TalkingSnooker. See you next time, sirs. I salute you. And say what?
I slip back. Yep, thanks for listening.
What a shame about that bloody rigging. God, they were noisy, weren't they, in Poland? We'll let them off. But listen, there we are. We enjoyed recording this episode. We hope you enjoyed listening. It's always great to have you for company. And now, from Phil and myself, we say cheerio.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.